Hey, it's Tony and Melissa. Thanks so much for listening to our podcast.
Here are some of the best parts from today's show. Hope you'll subscribe, share, and like us.
A very, very interesting story that I was just reading. It's very amazing. There was a guy by the name of Hezekiah Perkins, and he served in Korea. Well, he passed away earlier this month at the age of 90, but his only living family member is a daughter who has some health problems, and she couldn't go to his funeral in Cincinnati. So the cemetery put out a request that said anyone who wanted to come was welcome. And on Saturday, around 400 people showed up for his service. Most of them lived in the area, but people came from all over. One woman said she drove about 100 miles from Kentucky just to be there for it. Now, Hezekiah was buried with full military honors, and someone set up a live video feed so his daughter could watch. According to the funeral director, she was so grateful she broke down in tears when she saw how many people came out to honor her dad. And you know, Alan, in my opinion, that's what Memorial Day is all about. I mean, this is like a bittersweet story. It's sad because somebody passed away. Look at all of the people that didn't even know him that came out and wanted to pay tribute to him.
Well, people understand what the sacrifice is that our military men and women who've served, what they were able to do for us.
Yes.
So I think enough people, hopefully everybody ultimately understands that. But yeah, enough people came out and paid their respects.
Yes,
that's great.
It is. It really is a great story. And like we said, I hope everybody had a great holiday weekend. But Memorial Day means just a little bit more than a barbecue and getting a great deal on a car or a mattress. In my opinion, it may seem a little somber, but this is what it's all about.
Everything you need to know, the moment you want to know it. Always count on WICC 600.
Okay, we've got 6:52 now here at WICC 600. Every Tuesday at this time, we take a moment and we speak with Lenny Grimaldi. Lenny, of course, writes a blog called Only in Bridgeport. This guy eats, sleeps, and breathes Bridgeport, and we're lucky to have him here every Tuesday. Lenny, how you doing this morning? Good to have you here.
Well, that's quite a diet to have, huh? I love it.
That's why you stay in such good shape. Oh, all right, let's get rolling here. What's the latest on Steel Point, Len?
You know, it's interesting. When was the last time you heard anyone move their company from Miami, Florida, to Bridgeport? Well, it's in the process. It's happening. The city is recapturing its waterfront, and one of the driving forces behind that is RCI Marine and Bridgeport Landing Development. So within the next week, you're going to have an opening of the Boca Oyster Bar on Steel Point, 200 Slip Marina, public walk area. So I had a tour of this facility on Steel Point, which is off of Stratford Avenue, not far from downtown. It's an exquisite view of the waterfront. In fact, it's a view of the city that has not been seen in 100 years. What used to be located there was an old industrial power company. The site has been cleared and cleaned up, and RCI Marine is going to be moving into there along with this oyster bar, the marina, public walk area. So the whole section of the east side is getting cleaned up. So that's the latest news at Steel Point, and it's going to be happening with sometime this week.
You know, you say that we're going to see parts of Bridgeport that haven't been seen in such a long time, so it's kind of strange in a way because it's a brand new thing, brand spanking new, but yet we're going to see some history here as well.
Yeah, so, you know, as a Bridgeport historian, is fascinating for me because when I took a tour of the property there a few weeks ago, I'd never seen that vantage point of the city. I mean, it's just a spectacular view of the waterfront because you had no access to it. It was blocked off for a long time because of that power plant that was there. Now, Steel Point development has been, you know, a long time in coming. It was proposed decades ago, but there's been progress there, you know, in the last, you know, 6 or 7 years with the opening of Bass Pro Shops across the street. So when you're driving along I-95 and you're looking at that development that's going on, you see the Bass Pro Shops. This is directly across the street on the other side of Stratford Avenue, where you see the Dockmaster building, the Lighthouse building, and inside of that is going to be the Boca Oyster Bar, Tuner Slip Marina, and the Bridgeport Boat Works, which will be servicing the vessels at the marina. So that the Bridgeport Boat Works, it's an incredible location that's fixing up the vessels there. And Bob Christoph Sr. and Jr., they're boaters. They have lots of contacts in the boating industry, and it's materializing into this really cool hamlet along the waterfront.
We're taking a moment here. We're speaking with Lenny Grimaldi. Of course, his blog is Only in Bridgeport. You know, that leads me to my next question. What about the Bridgeport gaming situation? I mean, is there going to be a casino? Is there not going to be a casino? What do you think, in your opinion?
Yeah, I wish I knew the answer to that. I mean, so this is the final week of the legislative session. It ends June 5th, and there's a swirl of issues that are being kicked around up there, including potential gaming, sports betting, and other issues. So it's unclear whether this is going to be resolved within the next week. So likely, according to most of the legislators up there, there's probably going to be a special session to address either one, tolls, gaming, sports betting, who knows, maybe all of the above, because their work might not be completed in time. So don't know if this is going to be resolved within the next week. It's probably going to extend out, so it could happen or it could not happen. It's been, you know, a work in progress. It's not an easy gaming in Connecticut is complicated because of the state's gaming compact with the two tribal nations. The state receives 25% of the slot take in exchange for granting exclusivity. So if you're going to negotiate a new gaming pact in the state, it has to be done with the tribal nations.
Lenny, I thank you so much for taking a few moments. Unfortunately, we've run out of time, but I urge you, check out Only in Bridgeport. That's onlyinbridgeport.com, right, Len?
That's it. Come on by.
All right, so check it out. I mean, all things Bridgeport are right there, and Lenny does a great job. I don't know how he covers it. He probably just doesn't sleep, but that's okay. We need this kind of thing here to read up on Bridgeport. Lenny, thank you so much. We'll talk to you next week.
Okay.
Good morning, Mike. How are you?
Good morning, and thanks for inviting me on today.
I'm so happy that we could have you. So first of all, I understand that teachers are reaching out to you specifically and other first selectmen. Why are they reaching out to you?
Well, there's a proposal at the state to take this pension cost for teachers that the state is supposed to be funding and pass it off to the towns, or at least pass a portion of it off to the towns. And I think the feeling is that it's a state program, a state obligation. The state promised to pay for it for the teachers, and the state should pay for it. The slight problem is that the state hasn't funded it properly. So as much as the towns have been sending in our tax dollars, our residents have been paying our tax dollars to the state did not fund the teachers' pension costs, so the amount of money owed has ballooned to a dramatic number.
And what exactly is that number?
That could be up as much as $6 billion per year.
Wow. And for Fairfield specifically, I think I saw on a blog that you were writing something about $700,000. What is that? Because when you see that number, a lot of times people will think, oh, that's coming to Fairfield. That's a good thing. That means that's money for us to spend. But that's not the case.
Oh, not in this case. It's another unfunded mandate from the state. What the state's doing is saying each town should pay a portion of this $6 billion. And so they've allocated a growing amount to Fairfield, $700,000 in year one, $1.4 million in year two, $2.1 million in year three. Collectively, for all the towns, that would amount to $75 million, which really doesn't make a dent in $6 billion a year. But more importantly, the state's handing off the costs and not changing anything about the program. They've got a program they can't afford that they haven't funded, and now they want the towns to clean up the mess.
And we are speaking right now to First Selectman Mike Tetreault out of Fairfield. And we're talking about the state teacher pension costs and how it's now transferring to towns. And this seems to be a really big problem. So, Mike, first of all, why is this even, I guess, why is there even a state teacher pension, I guess? Why is this even in place if this is going to mean it's a backlash not only onto teachers but onto the towns, like you're saying, Fairfield or Trumbull or the surrounding towns in our listening area?
Some number of years ago, and I'm not sure exactly how many, but I think it's literally 30 or 40 years, the state made an agreement with our teachers throughout the state that they would pay for the pension. They'd establish a pension program, and they'd pay for it. The state then proceeded not to fund it. So if you look at a town like Fairfield, we're third in the amount of income tax dollars we send to Hartford to fund the state government. In the last 4 years, between income tax and sales tax, our residents have paid $1 billion to the state, and that's, so we've done our fair share. The state's coming back and asking for more money that would, in fact, raise our property taxes, make housing more expensive, hurt our seniors. That's exactly what we don't want to have happen. It would also put pressure on our educational budget. And when we're trying to sit here and fund our schools properly, the last thing we need is additional expenses handed down from the state that they just don't want to pay anymore.
I was going to say, every time I think about things like this where we're cutting costs or we're having to pay back things like that to the state, do the schools, they get, I would think, affected directly? Like, does this mean that certain programs will get cut, or does it mean that people will be out of a job? I mean, what are we looking at? I would think long term, this could cause a lot of huge issues.
Well, what it does is put a lot of pressure on the town to either cut expenses, and we've been cutting those as much as we can in past years, or raise taxes, which we don't want to do. Raising taxes forces people like our seniors to make their housing less affordable and potentially force them to leave our town. These are our neighbors. We don't want them leaving, and we certainly don't want them leaving because the state didn't fund this properly and is now passing the costs off to the towns.
And we've started to see that in Connecticut. It unfortunately is one of the top states that people are getting out of here so fast because it's getting so expensive to live here. Certainly a big concern. And we have First Selectman Mike Tetreault talking to us about the state teacher pension cost and how it's now being transferred to towns and having to cover those costs. And anything else to tell us, Mike? I mean, does it sound like a lot of other First Selectmen are on board? They're kind of following your lead with this? I mean, does it seem like you have a lot of support to fight this?
Oh, very definitely. I think First Selectmen all around the state are reaching out to their residents to get them to write their state representatives and state senators and write the governor and tell them this is not the time to transfer the costs for this state obligation onto the towns. Simply put, it's a state program, and the state should pay for it.
And really quickly, before I let you go, why do you think this hasn't really come up on the radar? Because I think for the everyday person, including myself, until you emailed me directly, I didn't know anything about this. And I think sometimes these are big expenses. You're talking about $700,000 for Fairfield alone. That's a big expense to kind of let fly under the radar for the everyday person. Why do you think that this hasn't been brought to the forefront?
Well, I think there have been a lot of very controversial issues in the recent months about the budget. You've had tolls, you've had regionalization of schools, and they've kind of taken up the bandwidth in the media headlines, and that's let the spotlight not focus so much on something like this that's very significant.
Well, we are so glad that we got your perspective. Thank you so much for being with us. First Selectman Mike Tetreault with Fairfield, we appreciate it, and good luck with your efforts.
Thank you, and thanks for the opportunity.
It's 9:30. Do you know what time it is? It's time for the Coffee Break Chat on WICC.
All right, it's time for Crime on the Mind, and once a week, we try very hard to connect with Lieutenant Jim Perez, and he's here this morning to kind of watch out for you, if you will. Lieutenant, how you doing this morning?
Good. I'm doing very well. And yourself?
All right. We're doing good. So glad you're here. Recently, you reported bank and jury duty scams. In fact, you said someone just lost close to $2,000 recently because of a spoof bank call. Now, talk to us about these calls and what they sound like. How can you tell it's a scam? What can we do to protect ourselves?
Right. Well, first of all, spoofing is something that it's a resource that's used on the Internet. And what it does, it masks a phone number, so they can pick any company, reputable company, and they can make as if that company is calling. So it's very important that you don't completely trust your caller ID. If you see a number that you've dealt with before, even if it is a bank or a town government or a state government, always hang up or don't answer the phone, and then go back and look at the directory and actually call them. But, you know, the most important thing is scammers use psychological tactics to actually get you. They use this term called scarcity, where they try to actually scare you into believing that you're going to, that you know, that if you don't comply with them, that, you know, there's going to be a price to pay, whether it's jail or whether it's, you know, some type of fine. You know, they also use social consensus. They want you to believe that everybody else is going through the same thing. We're all taught to respect authority. And unfortunately, source credibility is another tactic that they use to try to build, you know, credibility with you by claiming to be like some reputable firm or something. In the case of the bank one, this victim literally got a phone call from the bank, and on her caller ID, it said the bank, so she was inclined to believe it was the bank, when in reality, it was scammers. They first asked for information. Understand one thing, that for scammers, your information, your personal information is more valuable than cash in front of them, because they can continually make money. How? They end up opening up accounts under your name, whether it's your social and date of birth. They open up credit cards. They open up telephone bills, electricity accounts. And the thing is that you won't, as long as they're paying it, you're not going to know. But the minute they stop paying it 3 months later, you're going to start getting collection notices. And that's where scammers, the Federal Trade Commission reports billions of dollars are lost every year to these scammers. And really, our goal is to make sure that you are a small target. How do you do that? Avoid telemarketers. You know, don't just answer every phone call, and do not give out information. There is no reason, no local, state, or federal agency will ever, 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 and I mean with a capital E, ever, call you out of the blue or require some information through the internet. They usually will send you a mail, or generally, it's you that initiates the conversation. So if you initiate a conversation with Social Security, let's say, administration, then that's one thing. But if you get an email saying that Social Security needs to be updated, or in this case, she received a phone call saying that People's Bank needed to update her information, don't believe it. And if anybody tells you that you need to pay by credit card, but if you have to pay by gift cards or anything like that, hang up the phone. The goal should be to become a small target, and you do that by avoiding people. Normally by avoiding these phone calls and not actually talking to them. You don't have to talk to them. There's no reason for you to. So don't respond to letters or internet offers. Resist giving out your personal information. Very important here, opt out of telemarketers list. There is this marketing firm, DMA, that's just over the line in New York. That's the mothership of telemarketers. They have all your information. By federal law, you can call them and request that your information be taken out. And just be aware of your surroundings and be aware of who you're dealing with. If you did not initiate the call, don't believe it.
We're taking a moment here talking to Lieutenant Jim Perez. The name of the segment is Crime on the Mind. Now, once you've been scammed, is there any way to get that money back, or is it highly unlikely that you'll ever see that again?
And there are some rare cases where you can get a return of the money if we have the suspects. Years ago, we ended up catching these Nigerian scammers, and they were actually operating out of the country, but we caught them in the country. But most of the time, you will lose that money. And if you wire money, it's gone instantly. The minute, wiring money is basically money transfer. But if you do that, you can just, if someone says to you that you need to pay a bill by wiring money, don't believe it. Because once you give that 14-digit code up, your money's gone. But in most cases, you will not, to answer the question, you will not receive that money back. But you can repair your credit and repair the damage that's done by, you know, filing a police report first and foremost, and then after that, contacting the relevant federal, state, or local agencies or even a local bank that's been affected.
Lieutenant Perez, how can we protect ourselves? You know, how do we get them to stop?
Well, you know, laws are being enacted now as we speak to actually try to reduce the amount of robocalls that we get. But unfortunately, 45% of robocalls are scammers, and it's very difficult to do. That's why I tell everyone that what you need to do is just stop responding. Make yourself a small target. If you don't initiate the phone call, don't listen. I said this a long time ago, and it's true. With the advent of the internet and computers, every single one of us has, you know, for lack of a better word, a grenade in our living room, okay? That's the computer, the internet. I can't remove that grenade from you, but I can certainly teach you how to avoid detonating it and how to avoid it. And that's through you know, being very careful on the internet, not answering phone calls that you're not familiar with. You know, they can put in all kinds of viruses into your phone and into your computer the minute that you respond to or answer a text. So it's very important. If you don't recognize it, just simply don't do it. The other thing is, just know that by law, every citizen, by federal law, is allowed 3 credit reports a year from all 3 credit bureaus. I would say take advantage of that. Call the credit bureaus and get your credit and look and see to make sure that all your information is in check. You will be shocked at the number of information that's not valid or accounts that are on your back that you have no idea about, and then close those immediately. But by doing these things and not responding to telemarketers and not answering, it's okay to hang up on. By the way, I am deputizing everybody that can hear me. Everyone that can hear me, all your listeners are being deputized to just answer, to just hang up the phone if someone calls, if a scammer calls. You don't have to feel inclined to actually talk to them. If they ask you for personal information, you do not give it. You simply hang up the phone.
Well, you know, we go by the rule in our house. If you don't recognize the number, don't pick it up. If it's important, they'll leave a voicemail. If it's something that is legit, they will get in touch with you. You know, and as far as the landline, I'm one of the last people in the world probably that have a landline in the house. They are relentless. I mean, they call 8:30, 9:30, 10 o'clock at night. You know, it's just amazing. Now, in your opinion, who's most likely to get these calls? Is there a target, or is it just random?
You know, most people believe that the victims that we have are either not intelligent or are not savvy, and really that's quite the opposite. Most victims are very they're very successful in life, whether it be through work or through monetary or however it is. These people are used to, you know why? Because these people are used to winning. They're used to winning. They're used to actually succeeding. So when the scammer calls and they use these psychological tactics, you actually have an affinity for it because you've been through that success. So it's really quite the opposite. Anyone can become a victim. And really, the scammer doesn't care. They don't care whether you have $1 million in the bank or $2,000 in the bank. They want to part with whatever they can, and they will do it if you're not aware of your surroundings.
Lieutenant Perez, we've run out of time. If people want more information, what can they do?
Well, they can go to the Federal Trade Commission site. There's also a consumer.gov site they can go to where they can learn lots of information. Their Federal Trade Commission is the actual federal agency that really collates and takes all the information in and actually has an educational piece. So I would urge everyone to go to the FTC site and really start to take that information in because it's extremely important.